we have this treasure in clay jars so that this extraordinary power may be from God and not from us. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. We are persecuted, but not abandoned. We are struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry the death of Jesus in our body, so that the life of Jesus may also be displayed in our body. For we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that Jesus' life may also be displayed in our mortal flesh. So then death is at work in us, but life in you. And since we have that same spirit of faith in keeping with what is written, I believed, therefore I spoke, we also believe and therefore speak. For we know that the one who raised the Lord Jesus will also raise us with Jesus and present us with you. Indeed, everything is for your benefit, so that as grace extends through more and more people, it may cause thanksgiving to increase to the glory of God. Therefore, we do not give up. Even though our outer person is being destroyed, our inner person is being renewed day by day. For our momentary light affliction is producing for us an absolutely incomparable eternal weight of glory. So we do not focus on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal.
Howdy, everybody. My name is Noel, and I'm either a prophet or a meteorologist, because last week, Alex, right here, got on stage and told all of us that winter wasn't coming back. And then here on Sunday morning, we get a good snowstorm, so I just want to say, I may not be a prophet, I may not be a meteorologist, but I'm right and you're wrong. That's all that really, really matters, Alex. And so, so let's close in prayer. So we have all heard the phrase, don't judge a book by its cover, right? We've all heard that phrase. Well, and we probably all have countless examples in our lives where we've seen that thing bear true. And for me, my favorite is something that my kids tell me that I'm old for loving because I still love this and I can't stop. And it is music reaction videos. And I don't know if you've ever seen these. You may be old like me and not know what it is. It's an old thing by now. But what it is it's these people who film themselves watching a musician they've never seen before or a song or music video that they've never seen before. And so we're watching them watching something else. And I absolutely love it. It's so like when an opera singer sees Eminem for the first time, it's absolutely amazing, right? Or maybe it's a country music fan that is seeing a heavy metal artist for the first time or something like that. I love all of it. And so for instance, one of my favorites is whenever somebody discovers for the first time that the Righteous Brothers are not black, they almost always have the same reaction. Or anybody who sees Chris Stapleton for the first time has essentially the same reaction. And so I don't know if you guys know Teddy Swims. You may or may not know Teddy Swims. If you don't, this is him. Teddy Swims right here. And if you don't know Teddy Swims, I just want you to take a look at him and imagine him as a musician. Now, some of you already know who he is. Some of you don't. But I want to show you somebody's first reaction to Teddy Swims singing. So check this out for a second here. Watch the rest of it when you get home. But some of your reactions, I was watching you watch this.
I was watching you watch someone else watch someone else. There's layers. But you had the same reaction that she did. And one of the reasons I love reaction videos so much is they show someone's stereotype being broken, right? And shattered. And what we see is that there's something inside of each one of these artists that transcends what people see on the outside. There's something different going on. And it's not just that it's like incompatible with their looks. It's like sometimes some of these artists, like Teddy Swims, they're incomparable with their peers, right? In how they perform. And the common theme in all of these reaction videos is, how can that come from that? So if you have your Bibles or your journals with you this week, we are going to be in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, and we're going to start where we left off last week in verse 7. And we're going to see this whole thing play out. How can that come from that? Let's start in verse 7. He says, now we have this treasure in clay jars so that this extraordinary power may be from God and not from us. And so the Apostle Paul starts with this word, this phrase, this treasure here. And what is that? Well, that comes from last week. And so if you were here last week, what he just got done talking about was the treasure of the gospel. And the pictures that Paul gave us is the gospel is a light that shines out from the darkness. It is a knowledge of God's glory that we see in the face of Jesus Christ. Now we covered all of that last week, but don't forget those two pieces. The gospel is the light that shines out of darkness. It is the glory of God that we see in the face of Jesus Christ. One of the downsides of modern church buildings like ours is we don't have a lot of imagery. We don't have stained glass. We don't have portraits. But as I travel around the world, especially in places like Europe, and I go through old church buildings, there's always stained glass and imagery and paintings and things like that that hang. And a lot of this pictures are of Jesus. And many of them, they show a particular moment in the life of Jesus, and that is his crucifixion, which means the face of Jesus is often one of agony. Like this famous French painting right here, this is part of what's called an altarpiece. And it's from the 16th century. And this altarpiece meant that this was the image that was right on the front of the communion table, the Lord's Supper table, right in the center of the service. And so anyone who went and attended church at any time, this is the image that they would look at during the entire service. And then when they would come forward to take the Lord's Supper and they'd come to the altar place, this is the image they would look at while they were taking the Lord's Supper. And the good news, what Christians call the gospel, is that light came from this darkness. The good news that the gospel of Jesus declares is that God's glory is seen shining in the face of Jesus. As Paul wrote, the extraordinary power came from God, not from us. Now, this has eternal implications for those of us who believe, but this also has implications for each one of us right now in our daily lives. Look at verse 8 and 9. He says, we are afflicted in every way, but we are not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. We are persecuted, but not abandoned. We are struck down, but we are not destroyed. Do you see what the Apostle Paul is saying? What he's saying is there is a difference between what is happening to us on the outside and what is happening in us on the inside. That you might look at us from the outside and not understand what God is doing inside of us transcends what you can see. So what Paul says is remarkable. He says, we are afflicted, right? And you might assume when someone says that they are afflicted, that means they are crushed. But he says, no, we are afflicted, but we are not crushed. He says we are perplexed. And I love that phrase because perplexed means exactly what it means. It means that Paul and likely Timothy who was with him and Silvanus who was with him, they were perplexed, which means they looked at their life and what was happening to them, and they could not come up with an earthly reason why it was happening. They were confused. They were perplexed. But even in being perplexed, he says, we are not in despair. He said, we are persecuted, but we are not abandoned. They knew that God would not leave them even when they were being persecuted. And he says, and everyone around us can see that we are struck down, but I am here to tell you, we are not destroyed. And the reason for his hope is in the next two verses. We always carry the death of Jesus in our body so that the life of Jesus may also be displayed in our body. For we know, for we who live are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that Jesus' life may also be displayed in our mortal flesh. This is the beauty of the gospel, the good news of Jesus. Jesus didn't stay dead. Jesus died on the cross. He was buried, but then he rose again and he is still alive. In fact, most Protestant churches, when they do happen to have a cross in their building, we don't typically have Jesus hanging from the cross. And one of the reasons is it's an acknowledgement that Jesus has risen from the dead. He is no longer on the cross. He has been buried and he has risen from the dead. And 3 weeks from now, we're going to celebrate that on Easter. And one of the ways we're going to do that is through baptism. And baptism has that same symbolism, the fact that people who have trusted in Jesus will come up on the stage and they are going to be placed. We use a horse trough for baptisms because, you know, the baptism racket. It's really expensive to buy a baptismal, but horse troughs are cheap. Tractor Supply Company, so we got one of those. And and they're right there. Jesus was born in a stable. We can use a horse trough. So people are going to go down into the water, and they're going to be placed under the water, symbolically declaring that their old self has been crucified with Christ, dead and buried. And then they're going to come back out of the water, symbolizing the new life that they have in Jesus. That's what we're going to declare in 3 weeks. And here's the fact. Death may keep knocking on our door. We may be afflicted and perplexed and persecuted and struck down, and that may be all that anyone ever sees on the outside. But we know, as followers of Jesus, that inside we have this treasure, that inside we have life. But let's be honest. It doesn't always feel that way, does it? And there's a couple reasons for that. The first is we do suffer. We all face affliction, and affliction that is deserved and affliction that is undeserved. There's things that we have caused, and then there's things that have been done to us. And then we flip open our news app and we read about wars and famines and celebrity divorces, and everything can just seem so overwhelming. And that's one of the reasons this world feels like death. The second of it is actually psychological. I'm reading a book right now that's great. I'm actually about two chapters in, so two chapters are great. No full stunning endorsement. But it's called Factfulness. And here's the subtitle of the book, Factfulness. 10 Reasons We're Wrong About the World and Why We Believe, Why Things Are Better Than You Think. Now, there's so much in this book I don't have time to cover, and it's only been two chapters. But the authors, what they do is they do a data-driven analysis of our world and how it is comparatively great compared to any other time in human history. Now, here's the deal. If you don't believe that, you have been duped. That's the whole point of the book. And not just by the typical culprits, which is the traditional media and social media, so I can just get both sides, right? You have been duped by your human psychological wiring. We always, even if we're optimists, I'm an optimist, we always think things are worse than they are. We are hardwired, and I believe it's from our sin nature, to focus on the negative, to focus on how things are terrible. And if that's true, that that's in our wiring, and I think it is, it comes from original sin, we can miss the gospel pivot in this passage. Watch this. Paul writes, simple, verse 12. So then, death is at work in us, but life in you. What does that mean? Well, here's the thing. The Apostle Paul's ministry was marked by suffering more than you can ever comprehend. If you think you've been persecuted for what you believe, whatever that may be, whether you're a Christian or not, and you think you've been persecuted for what you believe, you have nothing on the Apostle Paul who wrote these words. In June, we're going to cover chapter 11, but I figure I won't even remember the sermon in chapter 11, so you won't, so we can jump ahead to it and then come back, okay? I want to take a second to read what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 11 about the trials that he has faced. Let me read a few encouraging words for you. He says, I've faced far more labors, far more imprisonments, far worse beatings, many times near death. 5 times I received the 40 lashes minus one. And there's a reason it's called the 40 lashes minus one. The whole idea is you beat somebody 39 times, they won't die at the 40th, right? So it's like this whole thing, it's part of the way they beat someone. So he had that 5 times from the Jews. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I received a stoning, which means they threw rocks at him. It's not like it was recreationally legal there. Once I received a stoning. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I have spent a night and a day in the open sea. In other words, probably adrift, lost at sea. On frequent journeys, I face dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my own people, dangers from Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers at sea, dangers among false brothers, toil, hardship, many sleepless nights, hunger, thirst, often without food, cold, without clothing. Not to mention other things, there is the daily pressure on me, my concern for all the churches. In other words, worrying about the churches is worse than all of that. We'll cover that in June. Until you have been lashed with a leather whip 195 times for your beliefs, until you've been beaten with wooden rods, until you've had people throw rocks at you, you haven't quite faced what Paul faced. And we should take that as a grand encouragement. Let this settle in. Your pain is real. Your suffering can sometimes feel just absolutely unbearable. And what you have is you have someone in Paul who has just faced all of that stuff that I just described. And he is able to say, so then, death is at work in us, but life in you. What's he saying? He's using his own life as a sort of gospel metaphor. And he's painting a picture for his readers to see that the suffering that he had faced in some small way was leading to their life, just as Jesus's suffering leads to ours. How is that? Well, Paul's pain is happening precisely because of his ministry. He could have at any point just gone and retired at a nice seaside cottage and fished for the rest of his life, and yet he didn't. He continued on with his ministry, and the reason he did that is he saw that it was worth it. As he traveled around the known world, as he planted churches, as he wrote letters, even when he got in prison for doing these things, he would hear that people were hearing the gospel, that they were placing their faith in Jesus because of what he was doing. They were moving from death to life. And Paul's like, it is worth it. Verse 13, he goes on and says, and since we have the same spirit of faith in keeping with what is written, that's important, hold on to that. I believed, therefore I spoke, that's a quote. We also believe and therefore speak. So whenever Paul quotes something, I want to see what he's quoting. So he's quoting a psalm here. So I flip back to the Psalms. And if you go to Psalm 116, this is the psalm that Paul is quoting. So if you're a Bible flipper, you can just do this. Keep your hand there. Psalm 116, this is what the psalmist says. Starting in verse 7. Return to your rest, my soul, for the Lord has been good to you. For you, Lord, rescued me from death, my eyes from tears, my feet from stumbling. I will walk before the Lord in the land of the living. I believed, even when I said, I am severely oppressed. I once heard somebody say, the problem that we have is we don't talk to ourselves enough, which is encouraging because I talk to myself all the time. But in this passage, you see what he's saying. He basically talking to himself. He's talking to his soul. And he says to his soul, return to rest because the Lord has been good to you. And that is in the midst of what? it's in the midst of the time when he can declare, verse 10, I am severely oppressed. So right in the middle of being severely oppressed, he can look at his soul and say, the Lord has been so good to your soul. And then he could say, I believe even when I say I'm severely oppressed. And so that's what Paul is quoting that passage. So now go back to Paul. Now it makes sense. He says, and since we have the same spirit of faith in keeping with what is written. In other words, I was just reading the Psalms this morning. He's probably saying, okay, I was reading the Psalms this morning and came across the Psalm and I want to share it with you. That's sort of what he's saying. I believe, therefore I spoke, because the psalmist said, in the midst of suffering, severe oppression, he says, I believed. I believe and therefore I spoke. We also believe and therefore speak. And what do we speak? For we know that the one who raised the Lord Jesus will also raise us with Jesus and present us with you. This is his hope. The linchpin of Paul's whole argument here, and I'm going to be as clear as I can be, is the resurrection of Jesus. And if you don't hear anything else, hear this. If Jesus is dead, if Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, our faith is worthless and you should not believe in Christianity. But if Jesus is alive, if Jesus victoriously rose from the dead, conquering sin, Satan, death, guilt, and shame, you can know that one day he will raise you. And you can know that the suffering that you face right now is not meaningless. That even though there is death, there will be life. That one day Jesus will raise you from the suffering of this world and you will rise with him in glory. Our hope is based on the resurrection of Jesus, period, full stop. He says in 15, indeed, everything is for your benefit so that as grace extends through more and more people, it may cause thanksgiving to increase to the glory of God. I love this. Paul is saying, this suffering is worth it because as we suffer, the grace of God is going to, what does he say? More and more people. And I love this. Paul doesn't take any of the glory. He says it's all for the glory of God, right? He gets all the glory. And I don't want you to miss that phrase, more and more people. Let me say this as clearly as I can. I want our church, I want Riverview to grow. I want us to have a chair problem. I want us to have an auditorium size problem. I want us to add services back because we can't fit the people. And unapologetically, I want that to happen. And while inevitably, sometimes people move from church to church, that's not what I'm talking about. I don't want that. Don't care about that at all. What I want to see is the grace of God poured out through faith in Jesus, reaching more and more people. We should all want that. I want you to want that. I want you to be as excited about that as I am. Look at this phrase. He says, because what happens is when that happens, it will increase, it may cause thanksgiving. So what I want is for there to be thanksgiving on your behalf anytime there are more and more people placing their faith in Jesus. And what that means is if you come to church someday and it's not Time Change Sunday when some people sleep in, but it's one of those other weeks and someone's sitting in your seat, I want your reaction to be, yes, it's not your seat anyway. And that probably means that person hasn't been in that chair before, and maybe they wandered in for the first time, and their life sucks, and it's falling apart, and they're looking for something, and you should be excited that that person may be able to find that in the grace of Jesus. Therefore, Paul says, we do not give up. Even though our outer person is being destroyed, our inner person is being renewed day by day. Therefore, he says, he's been building to this moment. Therefore, we do not give up. On the outside, it might look like we're being beat down and perplexed and persecuted and struck down. We know that our inner person is being renewed day by day into the likeness of our Savior Jesus. And this is why Paul can be so confident. Check this out. It's a doozy. Verse 17. for our momentary light affliction is producing for us an absolutely incomparable, eternal weight of glory. If you didn't listen to that sentence closely enough, I want you to hear it again. For our momentary light affliction. What did he just assume? What did chapter 11 say? He was beat 195 times, hit with sticks. He was shipwrecked. He didn't have clothes. He didn't have food. Our momentary light affliction. He's like, so he says, you know what? In the grand scheme of things, I've discovered that what I'm facing, the suffering, the affliction, the pain, it is momentary. And not only is it momentary, it's light, right? It's nothing compared to. It says it's producing for us an absolutely incomparable, eternal weight of glory. So the sufferings, the afflictions we face, they are momentary, but the weight of God's glory is eternal. The affliction we're facing is light, but the weight of God's glory is eternal, right? It is weighty. There's a weightiness to that glory. And what Paul is doing is he's playing a comparison game between what he's facing on the outside and what God is doing on the inside. And what he's doing on the inside is that absolutely incomparable, eternal weight of glory. And don't miss this. It's not that the affliction will go away and it will be replaced by the glory. Check this out. The affliction is producing this absolutely incomparable, eternal weight of glory. You don't get the one without the other. So I was reading a guy named Tim Keller. And Tim Keller, he was quoting a philosophy professor from Yale. And the philosophy professor from Yale was quoting some unnamed female Christian mystics from the Dark Ages. Okay, so I know there's layers to that. But these mystics that he was quoting, they were contrasting the first century belief systems with what they were facing in the Dark Ages. And if you know anything about history, the Dark Ages were called dark because they were dark, right? And so these Christian mystics were part of that age. And what they noticed was that the New Testament gave them a picture for how to deal with their world. And what they basically said is they said, first of all, if you go in the first century, there was this group, they were called Stoicism, the Stoics, the Stoicism. So Stoicism are kind of like Vulcans, right? That's kind of their mentality. And their view was just accept suffering. Just take it and accept it. And they were kind of the life sucks and then you die opinion, right? That was their philosophy, just accept it. Then there were a group called the Epicureans, and the Epicureans were kind of like the hippies. So like think Vulcans and hippies, and they were there in the first century. And their whole thing was, I want to avoid suffering, right? I'm all about pursuing the good vibes, man, and life and projecting positivity and the whole thing. That's an Epicurean, right? Now, would you not say that those two things are still common today? Well, these mystics say those two were common in the Dark Ages as well. But these Christian mystics noticed that in the New Testament, there was a message that was neither accepting of suffering or avoidant of suffering. Rather, they said that the Bible teaches us that the gospel engulfs suffering. The gospel feeds on it. The suffering that we faced, especially the suffering for following Jesus, is fuel. It's fuel to the hope that we have in the gospel. And one of the reasons I believe so strongly in the resurrection of Jesus is the number of people who joyfully embraced that in the first century. One of the reasons I'm a Christian is I see the number of people who joyfully were tortured and killed rather than denying the resurrection. When you see that Jesus' disciples, and it's not just the original 12 minus Judas plus one, right? It was not just them, but it was also the hundreds of people that saw Jesus face to face that we see described in 1 Corinthians 14, that these hundreds of people were willing to go out and proclaim the message of Jesus, and they would not stop at that point and say, okay, well, Jesus was just a good teacher. Because they had seen Jesus face to face, risen from the dead. So they died for it. They were persecuted for it. For me, one of the most powerful images is Jesus' half-brother James, most likely his half-brother, who wrote the book of James. Because 30 years after Jesus had died, been buried, rose from the dead, James was standing on the highest point of the temple in Jerusalem. And below him, he could see the hustle and bustle of Jews from all the nations that had gathered in Jerusalem because it was Passover season. As he stood there, balanced at the top point, and behind him at the temple were a bunch of religious leaders that had led him to that edge of the temple. And they were demanding that James deny that Jesus was the Son of God and deny that Jesus had rose from the dead. Think about that. This is Jesus' half-brother. He grew up with him. He played hide and seek with him, right? So this guy knew Jesus. And then eventually he came to become one of Jesus' disciples. Imagine, if you have a sibling, imagine someone telling you that your sibling is divine. Anyone willing to call baloney on that? Right? Absolutely. And so this is Jesus's brother. And Jesus's brother had become an outspoken evangelist and church planter after Jesus rose from the dead, because he saw his brother risen from the dead. And so he's standing on the edge of the temple, and he's like, I can't deny that. And so instead, he saw all the people wandering around. He thought, this is a good opportunity to preach, and he began to preach. And he began to preach that Jesus is the promised Messiah, that he's seated at the right hand of God the Father, that one day he will come back and judge the living and the dead. And it enraged a couple of the religious leaders who ran up on him and pushed him off the temple roof. James landed, and miraculously his legs were broken, but he survived. So he pushed himself up onto his knees, and he began to pray to his brother, who was his God. It so enraged the people in the street, they started to grab stones to kill him. But someone ran up with a heavy wood post and just hit him across the back of his head and killed him. No one does that for a lie. Through his pain, James saw the same thing that Paul is referring to in this passage in 2 Corinthians, that the glory of God is incomparable and eternal, and that the weight of that glory in his life is so much more than anything that he's facing in this world. C.S. Lewis, in an amazing book called The Weight of Glory, C.S. Lewis says we're actually not actually in the world. His description is we're sort of out of the world looking into what is the real world, because our world doesn't see the whole reality. And this is part of his description. He says, at present, we are outside of the world on the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and purity of morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. Isn't that beautiful? It's like you're looking out the window and you see that there's dew on the ground when there's not snow, right? And you're like, but I can't smell it because I'm on this side of the window. He says, we cannot mingle with the splendors we see, but all the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. That someday, God willing, we shall get in. When human souls have become as perfect in voluntary obedience as the inanimate creature is in its lifeless obedience, then they will put on its glory rather than the greater glory of which nature is only the first sketch. Meanwhile, the cross comes before the crown. So how do we live now? Verse 18. So we do not focus on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. The world only sees what's outside of reality. And what's outside of reality is the clay jars of our life. That was the first verse. He said, we carry around this treasure of the gospel inside of clay jars. Think about a clay jar. It's common. It's fragile. It's easily scraped. When you drop it and you break it, you don't care because it's clay. It's dirt. You just throw it away. But God doesn't throw away the clay jars because he knows inside of the clay jar that is beaten and scratched and bruised and chipped is a treasure. And you may look at your life right now and feel that you are ordinary, or that you are beat up, or that you are fragile. And that's the very point. If you have a high view of yourself and you think you are God's gift to the world or God's gift to ministry, you are missing the glory that belongs to Jesus alone. You're stealing his glory that belongs to him alone. And so for those of you who have never placed your faith in Jesus, I would like to urge you to do it today. Especially if you have faced that suffering and that pain and it seems meaningless. I can tell you from my perspective, it is meaningless if the gospel is not true. But if the gospel is true, there's meaning and there's purpose. And even though there's death, there is life. And for all of us, if you're feeling beat down, lift your eyes from what is seen to what is unseen, to the eternal. And what we're going to do today is we're going to do this in a community fashion by taking the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is a symbolic moment for those of us who have placed our faith in Jesus. It's reserved for us. And it's a time for us to remember that Jesus shed his blood for us and gave his body for us. And there are tables all over the room with elements, and there's a double stacked cups, and there's bread in the bottom and then a cup and then juice on top of that. So just grab one cup. There's also gluten-free options there on the tables. But what we're gonna do today is we're gonna take this a little bit differently. We're gonna put back up that image from the 16th century painter in France. And I wanna encourage you to get up, go to one of these tables if you're a follower of Jesus, and then come back to your seat with the cup in silence. Today, just this one time, we're gonna use this moment to reflect, to gaze on the face of Jesus, which is the glory of God, and remember what it is that he did for us. And then as we drink the juice, we'll remember Jesus's blood that was shed for us. As we eat the bread, we will remember Jesus' body that was given for us. And we're gonna do that all together. So during this next few minutes in silence, reflect on what Jesus has done for you. That eternal, incomparable weight of glory that is held inside of you no matter what is happening on the outside. And head to one of the tables around the room, grab the elements, head back to your seat, and then Wendy will be back up to lead us through a time of taking that. Go ahead, go now.